His name is Tim Young. He's with Ag Target, and he is a hometown boy, Vincennes. And Tim, you have an opening comment for this fine group of people?
Just briefly. I thank Susan and Vincennes University and Dave for allowing me to come back. I'm one of the analysts that is not privileged being on the radio, and most of Dave's panels participate in his radio show. Continue to try to get in there, but that's a tough feat to accomplish. But I'm going to try to keep my attention on the group tonight. I'll admit I'm kind of torn. I have a freshman in high school that's starting on a varsity basketball team, and they have a game tonight. So I did turn my phone off, so I can't get any reports, but I'll try to keep my attention. The only thing I'll say about the grain market, and hopefully we can cover some of my ideas and the ideas the panel has with questions, but everyone says that prices are so low there's nothing to do. And I think one of the times that you're looking at is that volatility is going to continue to increase. We've seen a wide swing in prices last year. We came through with a good crop in the United States, which at some points this summer we didn't think it was quite as big as it ended up being. You guys ran the combines, and we pushed out the second largest corn crop in history, and I believe they've got the bean yield the largest in history per acre. So you guys are doing amazing things in the field, but don't think that the market can't do anything. About the time you get so bearish and everyone gets on one side of the ship, things could change. So I think volatility is still alive and well with the spec funds and the fund managers in the marketplace, demand throughout the world. And although everyone tells you that there's no demand for corn, no demand for soybeans, we are still pretty tight in the world on corn from a fundamental situation, still depleting stocks. And, yeah, we have record soybean stocks, but we're just one mediocre crop in the world from having good prices in soybeans again, or real bad if those crops continue to be good, South America. So hopefully you'll have some good questions for us. I know Dave will direct those questions, and maybe we can provide you with some good solutions or probable marketing possibilities for you in 2006.
Thank you, Tim. Next to Tim is a man named Mike Zuzulo. He's with Risk Management Commodities. That's in Lafayette, Indiana. Mike is on the air on our radio station every Friday morning at 9:50 Eastern Time. And I don't know what block you live in, so figure it out. And then in the afternoon at 2:06 Eastern, well, I guess it would be 3:06.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. He's on Friday. You got a card, figure it out. And, oh, by the way, Mike gave me a little tour of Vincennes on the way back from the restaurant, and he showed me where he had his wedding reception. So he is a hometown boy, too, in some regards. Mike, an opening comment.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight. Keeping in mind what Tim just talked about, real valuable information in the longer term, our opening comments are kind of more short term and what we've seen in the past couple months. Even though we think that July wheat's about 20 to 30 cents too cheap right now and undervalued, the new contract lows in Chicago wheat, you know, really doesn't bode very well for the grain complex. Did some looking, and in the last 30 days, Dees wheat's down 9.5%, Dees corn down almost 4%, and Jan beans, not including today's trade, obviously, down a little over 1%. The bulk of the wheat losses have happened since the USDA report, and that was a report where the USDA came out and said, hey, hardwired winter wheat ending stocks at 175 million bushels is the lowest since 1996-97. So we've got a very tight domestic carryover in wheat. We've got a very tight world stocks-to-use ratio in wheat on the low end of the last 20 years. So wheat continues to make contract lows and leads the corn lower. What does that say to us? Well, if you kind of put that together with the fact that crude oil, which a lot of speculators look at, and a lot of the speculators that think about the health and welfare of the world economy and the strength of demand in the world economy. When they look at crude oil and they see it went below its 200-day moving average and D's futures recently, you kind of combine that together with the wheat price action. What that says to us is that the dollar rally over the last couple months has really hurt dollar-denominated commodities. You know, with the renewed avian flu issue that, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about tonight, unfortunately, you know, we would suggest that probably commodities need a stimulus from the outside. And one of those things that we're looking for is to see if whether the Chinese don't come in and feel pressure from Congress in terms of tariffs and import restrictions, which there's bills, you know, up there in Washington, D.C., and we have a 2006 election, so there's a lot of people that are going to be stumping, talking about lost American jobs. And whether that's right or wrong, that's beside the point. They're going to be stumping, and they're going to be wanting to please their constituency. So our mindset is China probably isn't nervous about Bush because of where he's at in the polls, but they probably are a little bit more concerned about Congress because of the midterm elections. And if the Democrats want to take back some seats, they're probably going to be talking about unions, labor, lost American jobs. Will the Chinese then buckle and revalue their currency against the U.S. dollar? That gives the commodities a jump. Why? Because that means the Chinese can buy more of our goods. So that's kind of the outside stuff we're looking for. The last 2 months haven't been very kind to the grains, keeping in mind what Tim talked about in the longer term, and we think we need an outside stimulus like that Chinese revaluation.
Thank you, Mike. Next to Mike is Clayton Pope of Clayton Pope Commodities, and I think I've done my math and can figure out when he's on the air. He's on the air on Wednesday mornings at 8:50 Central Time, 9:50 Eastern Time.
There you go.
How about that, Clayton?
You got it.
Clayton is in Champaign, Illinois, and Clayton, an opening statement.
Okay. Well, thank you also, everybody, for coming out tonight. I guess I'm the only true outsider here on the panel, although I grew up in Champaign and went to U of I and then spent a number of years up in Chicago working in the commodities industry most of the time, and worked at the Board of Trade, was a member up there for a number of years. And then came back to Champaign about 12 years ago and have been working the retail end of the business since then. I do have one connection to Indiana, though. My son's a junior at Purdue, so I'm not strictly Illini. I got a soft spot for Boilermakers a little bit.
You need
I can only say that over here.
You need one with our team.
Yeah. Anyway, like Tim said, volatility, I think, is just going to be the key word in our future here right now. When you look at some of the turmoil in these markets and in what's going on in the world and the fundamental situation like the avian bird flu and the political turmoil in a lot of countries, the currency fluctuations, I just think that volatility is going to be with us for quite a while. And right about when you assume one thing is the absolute way it's going to be, like last spring when everything just looked absolutely horribly bearish and didn't seem like there's any hope, and then beans rallied buck and a half for $2 or something, I mean, that's the nature of this business, I guess. It's always changing, and it is really kind of one of the things that can make a lot of fun as long as you're disciplined and do your homework. But we're getting a lot of mixed signals, I think, as a result of that volatility. You've got a super strong dollar, like Mike mentioned. It's just absolutely amazing. I mean, even Warren Buffett, probably the greatest living investor there is on Earth, in the last year, he's lost, I read yesterday, $900 million being short this dollar. But in the year or two before that, he'd made about $2.5 billion. I mean, the guy plays for big stakes, no doubt about it. But here's one of the keenest minds there is, and he's just been absolutely flat dead wrong on this thing. And actually started to get out of some of his dollar shorts recently. But that just kind of shows what we're looking at. But here we have corn making contract lows today. You have gold and silver both skyrocketing today, making multi-decade highs. You know, right when you least expect it, who knows, maybe the hedge fund's appetite for tangible assets, including ag assets, might be reignited, so to speak, if some outside event did come and kind of cause, act as a catalyst to get that going, maybe like Mike mentioned. So anything's possible. But I do think that right now, when you just look at the grain fundamentals themselves, personally, speaking just of corn and beans, I think we are looking at an extremely bearish situation. And I've just seen so many producers with the attitude that they've taken their LDP in the corn, never really had an opportunity to do much in the beans, maybe 7 cents at the most, And they're sitting on an awful lot of inventory of both corn and beans. And maybe that's the right thing to do, maybe it's not. But we're all up here working as risk managers. And I just think that's too risky of an approach to take. And I think that a farmer, the tools are out there to allow him to protect or put a floor on the inventory he's holding or on new crop as well that hadn't even obviously been planted yet and constructed in a way that still allows for upside price potential. And that's the kind of thing that I think a farmer, to be doing his job right as a marketer, should be looking into that kind of possibility and those kind of opportunities because given the fundamentals as they exist now, I still think there's an awful lot of downside risk in these markets. But I wouldn't really be wanting to completely close the door on eventual price appreciation because, as we all know, anything can happen. But the tools are there to use, and I think it's partly our job to, tell you folks what our idea is on how to use them. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Clayton. Let's go ahead and look at prices today. At the board, January soybeans settled 576 and three quarters, down 15 and a half. March, 584 and three quarters, down 14 and a half. July, 596 and three quarters, down 13 and three quarters. Take it out to red line November, 603 and a half, down 13. Tim, it's already been alluded to several times at this table in opening remarks regarding bird flu. What do we know about bird flu right now, and how do we manage risk based on what we know and what we don't know?
Well, I figured Dave would give me the first fundamental question since I don't like fundamentals. So thank you, Dave.
You're welcome.
And I would say, speaking with Mike, Mike's probably going to do a lot better job talking about the bird flu. It seems to be up to date on it. And all I can tell you is, we all read multiple pages per day, and the bird flu issue is always at the top of the list probably for the last 30 to 40 days every morning when you come in the office or when you get up at 5:30, 6 o'clock and start reading at home. I would summarize my position in bird flu like this. The information we get out of the Asian countries, who knows where it comes from and how much of it's true, how much it's been diluted. My biggest fear is when we start to look at the economic situation, and some of this data we know is pretty clear, that the price of whole chickens in China has basically dropped out the bottom. And in a 30 to 40 day period, it's cut in half, if not more. And so my biggest fear of the products that we're worried about, soybean meal, soy products, and corn to feed birds or demand in the Asian countries, comes from particularly the idea that if we get the fear that the flu can be passed on from eating the bird. If human consumption of a bird causes the disease, I think that would be devastating to our markets in the short run because of lack of consumption. Otherwise, repopping of poultry, we all know, can happen pretty quick. Demand from that situation, I think, would be short term. So my biggest fear, summarizing, is consumption of the product itself. If that would be depleted, I'm worried about longer term demand.
Since you thought Mike would do a grand job of the question, give it to Mike.
Give it to Clayton. I think there's two things. One, I really try, and all these guys up here, we talked about it at dinner, we're trying not to be an alarmist in mindset, but it's a black hole in China. We just don't know what's going on. And what my biggest fear has been what happened in 1997 with the SARS virus, where a lot of bad things happened, where towns got shut down for days and weeks, where whole communities were shut in, and we didn't find out about it until almost a year later. So that's fresh in my mind. I guess the biggest point I'd like to make is it's easy to say, regardless of where you sit with bird flu, that there's more questions than answers right now. And the trade doesn't like that, typically. The trade does not like and doesn't want to put premium into a market where there's more questions than answers if it's a bearish issue. The exact opposite was the case the last 2 years with soybeans and China's demand. There's a lot more questions than answers about how good or how much better Chinese bean demand could get for our beans, and the market just kept going up and up and up over fundamental rationale, over value to beat the band. I mean, at one time last year, we pegged, using a model that we look at, that at the price of beans, we would have had to be back down to like a 150 or 120, something like that, carryover at over $8 beans or 770 beans, whatever we got to. So the market is probably going to adjust with a negative issue where you have more questions than answers. It's going to adjust negatively. I think the other thing, too, that brings up a good point is, why in the heck is gold rallying? Well, I think our mindset would be, why is gold rallying with the dollar rallying? That shouldn't happen. And a lot of old-timers will say to you, and there's probably some in this group that would say, and I'm part of this group, if gold rallies, then corn's right behind it in 6 months to a year. And I buy into that if the dollar's going down when the gold's rallying. But when they're both rallying, that says to us, hey, there's an issue where people in the spec community and the investment community are worried about the health of the economy. They're worried about the issues going on in the world. Whether it's avian flu or something else or a combination of things, they're gone to the safe haven things. What are the two major safe havens? Bonds, dollar, gold. And so that's where we're at right now, is we don't like the gold and the dollar rallying together. And our suspicion is the avian flu, since it's in human people now, we know that in China, the trade's saying, get me to a safe haven where I'm not going to lose a bunch of cash. And that could, you know, spell some problems for the commodities in the short term.
Clayton, is that what's going on? You're trying to get out of Dodge in the commodities, going into something more tangible, gold, silver?
Yeah, I do think that gold and silver are definitely looked at as a safe haven, I think. There's also an undeniable trend in a lot of other countries, particularly China and India, which, I mean, we've all read countless pages on, you know, what upcoming tigers they are. But their governments, both particularly China's, strongly encourage their citizens to own gold. And it's the exact opposite here. Our government in recent years has been pretty mute on the point, but you go back in history, in our countries, our government has been a very strong discourager of holding gold, to the point that it was even illegal to hold gold for a number of years. And so if you look at the numbers, you know, you always read these comparisons, you know, if the average Chinese citizen owned as much gold as the average American citizen or whatever, I mean, the sky is the limit on what gold and silver prices could do if the rest of the world starts to get gold fever, so to speak. The sky is the limit. I mean, I've gone to a gold conference the last few years down in New Orleans. Unfortunately, it was canceled this year. But the guy down there, Doug Casey, who's written several books on international investing, real fascinating guy. I went up to him one day and I said, I guess you describe yourself as a libertarian. And he goes, well, I used to at one point, but anymore I think I'd have to call myself an anarchist now. So, kind of a strange guy, but a real good investment mind. But his idea, he keeps saying gold isn't just going to the moon, it's going out of sight or something like that. And so, I mean, that's the mindset a lot of these people who are buying these metals, that, I mean, as strong as the stuff is, it's a fraction of what it was back in 79 and 80 when silver was $50 an ounce. It just went above $8 an ounce today for the first time in years. So it could have a long ways to go, and maybe it won't have a bearing on grains. I mean, that's the million-dollar question, I guess, but logic would say it would eventually have kind of a pull relationship. But let me just say one other thing real quick on this China thing. I was fortunate enough to visit China about 7 or 8 months ago, and the cities are amazing. I mean, they're every bit as modern as our cities here. But when you go out in the country, and I only went in the inland like maybe, well, 15 or 20% of the land mass in where the terracotta soldiers are in Xi'an. And you take a bus through those areas, and you have no idea how desolate that is. I mean, there's no comparison between their rural areas and our rural areas. And the point I'm trying to make is the communication that we kind of take for granted here anymore, it's just not there. And obviously, the Chinese technology is great and rapidly improving and so forth, but to try to get a handle on a situation like this, it is next to impossible to do it in a timely fashion. So the only reason I'm saying that is I think we're going to be living with the guesswork and resultant fear of just how widespread and how serious this thing is over there for a long time to come, in my opinion, just because it's much more difficult to keep tabs on or to get an immediate count on anything than it would be here, and that we would kind of tend to assume it would be easy to do, you know, just based on our experience here. It's a vast, vast country, and those rural areas are just incredibly sparsely populated. Everything's far away, and it is backwards. I mean, it's incredibly backwards. So the fear factor, like Mike alluded to, that's a very potent market force. And in general, it seems like a pendulum, and the market will tend to overswing, and that could spell trouble.
Tim, you don't like fundamentals, or maybe it's some technicals. Okay. Let's do the soybeans. Put them aside first. You were talking about high volatility in the soybean pit, and you talked about demand a bit and fundamentals a bit, spec a bit, and you know we were talking a little bit earlier about this range. And whether or not, how do we decide? Do we flip a coin? Because we're talking $2 up, $2 down, it seems like. What's your thoughts looking at the charts about potential price action in the next 60 days and then longer term?
All right, well, shorter term from a technical perspective. And I mean, you got all this news that we've talked about and alluded, and there's tons of other things. We're getting a new Fed chairman pretty soon. What's going to be his policies, and all those things fit in, whether you like it or not. People that trade, they want to find the cheapest item they can find, and soybeans is one of the darling of the spec world. So when they get started in one direction or the other, they're very difficult to stop. From a technical standpoint, we ran January beans up a couple times here recently in the 605, 608 area. Had a real tough time getting through there. Today we were down 15, 16 cents. Ran through an area that January soybeans had been finding support in the low 70s, low 80s, high 70 area. We went through that area today. I've been to the point that I've been trying for my aggressive clients to hedge January beans every time they got over $6. Very few farmers want to do that. They put them in the bin. They want to wait for them to get sky high. They don't want to be hedging them 30 days after they put them in the bin. But I'm short-term bearish beans, looking for a test of the 546 area. And if that would give away, I think you're trading down 516, 522 area. That would be an area that I'd have to seriously consider some call options to pass my ownership, like Mr. Clayton was talking about a few minutes ago. I'd probably buy some calls and sell the first bounce in the market to get out of the cash market. On the upside, I just see in the longer term that 646, from a technical perspective, lead soybeans is going to be a tough area. If you would... Any chartist, you can take a daily chart and draw a line off last year's high, last summer, and it's going to cross this midwinter on a weekly chart in the 630, 640 area, plus or minus a dime. You know, that line sloping down, so as time passes, it gets a little lower. So if you wake up some morning and see beans above 640, something's probably happened that we've talked about. Some new news that's forced a speculator in the market. We talked at dinner, and I alluded to this a couple of weeks ago when I talked to a group of bankers. I think your risk as a farm producer right now, we've seen $6 to $6.28 in new crop November soybeans in the past 30 to 40 days. Do you sell it? Good question. I will honestly sit here and tell you, and you walk out the door and say, man, that's some advice, but I think you could be wrong $2. Either direction. You sell them at $6 cash, you got risk to a little over $8 with the right fundamental happening. You don't sell them at $6, we produce another good crop in South America, follow it up with a good crop in the United States, probably on increased acres. We could revisit the 2000, 1999 low, 405, 415. So the question's in your camp, do I sell or do I not? So that's where I think volatility is going to be there, and you got to have a lot of flexibility in your positions. And you're going to have to lean on someone, learn how to use some options, in my opinion.
Mike, you said that we need a stimulus from outside, and lacking that stimulus, if we don't get it, be it the revaluation of the currency that you mentioned, be it some significant growing condition problems in South America, be it an extreme pickup in our demand, and our demand in beans has been okay, but nothing to write home about compared to last year. Mm-hmm. What is the downside potential, and how do you manage that downside potential?
Boy, what an easy question.
I'm going to give you tax cuts.
New farm program.
Yeah.
We're going to get to the root of this.
Let's go back to what Tim just talked about. Our philosophy has always been demand puts lows in markets. What's the major difference between in soybeans right now versus the last 3 years? We've got the worst export commitments, the lowest export commitments in the last 10 years for soybeans right now. So you put that on the table, and you put your question on the table, and it says to us, and I was talking to, I got down here a little early, I was talking to our branch office, Sherman, who's out here, and we just cannot let November beans go below $6 on a close if we're hedgers. If we are farmers, hedgers, price risk managers, we just can't let it go below $6. Does that mean you do 100%? No. That's what the problem was with this past year. It's not that people started too early, Dave, in selling beans. It's that they started doing too much too early. They started at profitable levels, and that was the right thing to do. If you do that for 10 years, you're going to be right 7 or 8 times out of 10 years by doing it that way. Start at profitable levels, but don't be so aggressive that you've burned everything up by the time you get a 60-cent rally. So our mindset is we cannot let November beans close below $6. If they do, then we're going to have to get into the mix, and we're going to have to do a 20% sale one way or another, maybe a combination of things, whatever is based upon the individual client.
You wouldn't recommend starting a hedge at the NOV 603.5 that closed today?
I am secure with saying a close below $6, because that gives our guys time enough to mull it over and crunch it in their heads. You just don't call a producer up and say, time to sell, and they're going to jump on and say, yeah, you're right, I've been thinking the same thing. You know, very few people are going to do that. So you've got to let it sit there and simmer a little bit before you pull the trigger. So we need a little bit of short covering. We need a little back and fill. We need to get back up to 620, 625, where we really want to start doing something. And, if we would, it's very simple to us. You give 625 no beans up to the 660 contract highs, be 40% hedged, and 40, 45% hedged in, a variety of vehicles that gives you upside potential. But if you are sitting with 450 beans next fall, you're not going to be sitting there and saying, why didn't you guys, you say your name's risk management, you sat there with all these other risk management guys in this panel and said you manage risk, we had $6 beans back in November, why didn't you do anything about it? I do not want to live with that. I can live with $8 because I can start selling 07 then. So that's where we're at.
All right, let's talk about the corn for a little while. At the Board of Trade, December corn, 192.75 down three today. Believe that's a new contract low. At least the 192.25 was, which was the low price today. March at 206.75 down 3.25. Next July, 222.25 down 3. December, 241.25 down 3 on the day. Clayton, you said that corn had contract lows while the gold and silver is setting contract highs. And then you went on to talk about the dollar a little bit, and you say it's a super, super strong dollar. And I know we've alluded a bit to it already, but explain how come this all is happening right now.
Oh, thanks. Well, I'll tell you, I've been beating my head against the wall on these currencies lately and keep reminding myself I'm supposed to be concentrating on grains because I can't believe how relentlessly bullish this dollar has been. But first of all, I'd say an old saying up on the floor or anywhere in business, I guess, is don't trade gold in the corn pit. I mean, we're here to handle your corn risk. And if you said if you're bullish gold and you really think gold's going to make a big difference in everything, then buy gold. But and I'm not saying you should have tunnel vision and only look at the corn price and ignore everything else, because that would be at your peril probably. But the most important things affecting the corn market are usually corn fundamentals, particularly the carryover. And when all is said and done, I kind of a firm believer that the carryover is by far the single most important, has the single most important impact on grain prices. So, and that'd go for the currencies too. I mean, if you do a long-term chart of corn versus the euro or the yen or the dollar, I have a real hard time finding any real strong correlation, inverse or direct, jumping out at me. I'm sure you can see for periods of time, 3 or 4 months, it's amazing. It tracks it exactly. Or 2 years before that, it tracks it exactly inversely. You know, so what good does that do you? Not a whole lot. So I think you got to consider those outside markets, but I don't think there's anything more important than the direct variables involved with, like, corn or beans or whatever. So it is something that would make me, for one thing, I think it would change the way I'd approach the market. For example, I'm pretty bearish on new crop beans, and I'm not very much less bearish on new crop corn. But because of the possible acreage switch, I definitely feel more negative on beans. No matter how bearish I was, I wouldn't suggest to a person that they sell 100% of the new crop beans, particularly at the elevator. You know, if the guy was really aggressive and wanted to do it with options or something like that, that's another thing entirely. But particularly because of what some of this outside stuff's doing, with gold and silver in particular, it makes me very wary. I would want to approach things with a strategy that would allow me to be pretty nimble, and I'm a firm believer in cutting losses. And it's difficult to cut losses with a cash sale. So my own advice would be to be probably 20% sold in the cash market, new crop, corn and beans, particularly beans, and I'd pick up the phone tomorrow and do it. I don't care. Maybe you're missing out a little bounce up to 610 or 612, but 605 I think is still an extremely attractive price considering the fundamentals we have. But then to go beyond that 20%, I would definitely use options, something I could run away from if things change.
Tim, Clayton was talking about carryover, the most important factor in grain price as well. I believe last year we had the largest corn crop in U.S. history, and I believe last year, compared to this year, year-to-year prices were 11¾ cents to the downside on lead option. Explain that to me, then.
I think you're reading my notes, aren't you? Yeah. One of my top notes that I had on top of my page here, I've seen Dave peeking over. Today, a year ago, we were at 203 December futures. Dec 05, which would have been in red, we were 243 this morning, or this afternoon we closed at 241. So next year's crop, almost the same price. Yep, we are discounted, and what are we going to add? $200 million to the carryover?
Yeah.
Year upon year, and may be growing. Who knows what the USDA will tell us next month. If I did my homework correct, and I'll tell you, I'm not a big fundamentalist, but the O Sparks company, I used to buy my fundamental information from them. Now they're Informa. It's tougher to get information, but I still do. And if I interpreted the data from them correctly, of course, last year we were above 2 billion carryover. But the previous year that I could find that in the corn market that we had a carryover above 2 billion was the 92 production year going into 93. And so what I did is I immediately went back in my files and found my chart books from 1992-93, and I found it very interesting that when we compare year upon year, and that information I came out with that March 03 futures on January the 1st was $2.16. March futures this afternoon closed at 206¾. So about a dime cheaper than what we were, very similar carryover stocks. Then I went ahead and seen, okay, we're in a bearish market. They say big crops keep getting bigger. What happened to March futures before it went off the board? on the last day of February, March futures was 212.75. Basically lost 4 cents. The low before March futures quit trading, 210. If I had a big blow up and we were doing PowerPoints, I could have brought you a chart that showed that you were just in a channel just like this. If you want to look at my chart book presently, March corn's going in a channel just about like this. Carry in the market, yes, no. So, you know, those of us in my side of the business, we try to find similar years and see what happened in the marketplace. Markets in the doldrums in corn. Can I sit here and tell you you're going to get a 20 or 30 cent rally? Well, since 1990, we average about a 23 cent rally, typical years. Post-harvest on corn. May not get it this year. Who knows if we don't get a catalyst. But I'm not a big bear in the corn market. New crop. Old crop needs some work. Hopefully we're close to a low. 184, 192 in lead futures should find pretty good support on the charts. If not, we could visit some lower prices. The key that I'm watching in the corn market, Dave, may not make much sense, but I'm watching lead wheat futures, 286 in the lead wheat futures. And I personally believe if we take out 286 in lead wheat futures, that could spell a little more bearishness in the feed grains than what I currently anticipate. So I'm an active trader in wheat. And if I was going to be a trader tomorrow, I'd probably be buying wheat and running a stop it on a close under 302. I've been trading wheat the last 6-8 months. To me, it's been the best market to trade.
Wheat market, Mike, that's one of your favorite subjects. You talked about July being 20 to 30 cents too cheap, and yet I want to talk a little bit about lead option month December. 306 and what?
Three quarters
today, off of 304.5. Traders talking about downside objectives and 297, 296. Could you tell us, you know, how wheat is going to get out of the doldrums, especially when you look at the demand, and especially when you look at like the fact that, again, we are sub on a huge South Korea overnight purchase of wheat.
Right. Well, first, I think it goes back to the dollar currency, that a lot of the dollar is traded in the wheat pit, in our opinion, Dave. And, you know, the winter wheat crop conditions right now are down 22% versus last year. That's why we feel like it's undervalued by the amount it is. And the funniest and strangest thing we've seen is the speculators and the spread traders have been selling KC and buying Chicago. And to us, that makes no fundamental sense whatsoever, because you've got the tightest stocks in Kansas City. You've got the worst crop conditions in Kansas City. You've got more acres in the winter here. And you've got an issue where the, you know, 10-day outlook in the weather, when you went from, you know, 60 degrees to 7 degrees, although it probably didn't do any damage, you just don't have a real fundamental case to be built to go ahead and sell wheat when you're looking at selling corn or selling beans or selling meal. You know, when you look at something to sell, if you're a grain pit trader, I guess wheat would be last on our list right now. So that's where we're at as far as the mindset. And, you know, the other thing, too, if we can't get a bottom in wheat, how are we going to get a bottom in corn? And I think Tim's point about that 287 level makes perfect sense from a standpoint of, where does wheat start to rob corn of feed demand? Where is it easier to feed wheat as opposed to corn? That's probably a tickle spot right there if the corn stays steady and the wheat goes down to that price level.
Stay with you, Mike. Let's switch to the cash side and talk about basis a bit. We've been seeing a pretty significant basis rally in the last couple of weeks. Central Illinois was 5 over today. Down by the river, St. Louis, I think, was 11, 12 cents over. Will basis and futures come together?
I think to the point where you have the pipeline get filled up again. I think our impression when we did a Bloomington meeting a couple weeks ago, our impression was you're getting a basis rally and thank you very much, a basis rally and a futures rally enough to just fill the pipeline. And I wholeheartedly agree with Tim on the idea that the near-term corn product, as long as we can't find a bottom, it has got to get more move down the pipeline and down the channel. But our mindset has been and continues to be either 184, and that's where December 1999 wheat futures went off the board in that area. We think 99 and what Tim was talking about, 92, 93, very similar scenario in Dease futures right now. So either 184 Dease futures or Thanksgiving, whichever comes first, is where the front-end corn futures will carve out its low. So that would suggest to us that basis could firm a little bit, but, you know, it's unlikely. At that point, it's probably if the futures rallies, then they're going to knock off the basis so they don't really change your cash price for the next 60 days.
Clayton, LDP has allowed producers to just throw the lock on the storage bin, at least in the short term, and play for the carry. will they get that carry come March, or if they want to play out to July? And how do they protect it?
Well, yeah, I think the back months of corn are offering a real gift here right now, because even if you've missed the boat on selling the nearby stuff, particularly if you have on-farm storage this year more than ever, that makes such a huge difference. But, I mean, that Dease to July spread is the widest that's been in years. It's almost 30 cents on today's close. And the way you'd go about it, I think the best way to go about it, there'd be two ways. If you don't mind capping price potential and you're just willing to accept the price that's out there now, July futures are 222, you could call your elevator and make a hedge to arrive sale or a futures only sale. And I would not lock in the basis now, because even though the nearby basis is firming up, I think the back month basis in most locations is still a little weaker than it usually is, just because it's been such a train wreck this year on spot or harvest delivery basis. So I still wouldn't be wanting to lock in the basis in any way, shape, or form in most locations. I mean, there's some extraordinary deals going on, like you said, it's 5 over in some areas and that kind of thing. But I still think basis has got a ways to improve. And I really think if futures prices do continue to slide, as I think they will in the big picture, that will add to more basis firmness down the road. So you could either do a hedge to arrive sale, a basis July futures, and so, at some point I think you could reasonably think that you'd get futures, or cash would be like maybe 5 under the July or whatever. So that'd be like 217, which is a heck of a price. Add that on to, something like anywhere from 36 to 48 cents in LDP, and you've had one heck of a corn year. If you don't want to actually lock in that price, I would do an option strategy using the July corn options, and again, work around that price, but do it in a way that would still allow for some upside potential. So instead of actually selling the futures, you might be short the 230 or 240 calls, something like that, and buy a put, too.
Can I follow up the basis?
Going to ask you to.
We all witnessed the worst basis, across the Midwest on both corn and soybeans that we've seen in history. They talk about gouging in crude oil. Jeff, close your ears for a minute. The grain buyers had everything lined up perfectly for them this year to buy your grain as cheap as they possibly could, from high energy costs to move it to the hurricanes that stopped the barge traffic. Lack of train cars, you name it. They used all excuses to get basis at historical wide levels. And we've seen that snap back. But like was alluded to, the basis in the front end is getting better, but the basis in the back end is still not that good. I plot basis in my computer every week at about 13 locations. And I'll just give you Vincennes for an example. Today, we were 18 under for spot corn. I've been keeping data on basis at Vincennes since 1987. And the range I have, high-low, is 8 over the Dease to 13 under the Dease for today. And you see we're 5 cents wider than we've been since 1987. January bid. Today in Vincennes, we're 16 under for January corn. I keep new crop corn and January. I go to the first week of January, and the range was 11 over the March,
to 1,100 the March for the first week of January. A nickel outside that range also. So that's just proven data that you got to have something to compare to. You just can't say the basis is too wide or the basis is good. You got to use some records. So it's showing us that, hey, there's some good potential. I went one step further and I went back and said that last year that we had carryover at 2 billion plus. So that was the 92-93 area. So I went in there and seen that on this given day, spot corn was at 12 under in Vincennes. So we're 6 cents wider, basically, than we were same stocks level as in 92-93 as we were today. I went back and I looked, well, what were we on January 1st in 92-93? That would have been January 1st of 03. Minus 9 to March. So we're 7 cents wider today for Jan corn than we were in 93. And then I plotted that ahead out to what happened between there and the end of February. I seen a basis appreciation of 15 cents. The best basis we had at Vincennes in 93 was at the end of February at 6 over the March. So I agree. I wouldn't hedge. I wouldn't make a cash contract. I'd give the basis a chance to appreciate. And you have to watch that very closely, and you need some information to what is a good basis and what is a bad basis.
All right, everybody, get your pens out because I'm going to ask the question you all want to know. And I ask it just as blunt as I can ask it. And I'll start down to the other end with Clayton. Clayton, based on everything you know. What is your marketing recommendation on November 16th for new crop corn and beans?
For your typical, well, you know, everybody's different. Everybody's got a different risk profile, but the average, I don't know. Here's what I'd say: I would be 20% sold in cash corn and beans right now. It's unfortunate to sell it right now. I mean, I've sold at better levels, but I don't think it's worth screwing around with, in all honesty, to try to squeeze 3 or 4 cents improvement out of the corn market and maybe 5 cents or a dime out of the beans, because I think the downside risk is great enough that I just get it done. I would, in addition to that, I would want to have option protection on to bring my bean protection up to 50% right now. On rallies, I'd selectively go higher than that. Corn, I'd go to 30 or 40% sold, you know, so 10 or 20 in addition to the 20% cash sold with options, but I'd feel a little bit more imperative about the beans. If a guy really wanted to be aggressive and use option strategies, and I know he was a disciplined trader, I would have no problem with going to 70% or 100% protection in beans, but not with a guy that has a record of, like, freezing and hanging on to a loser, because these markets can be too unforgiving. And if a guy knew his discipline and he wanted to get 75% protected on his new crop beans, I would not argue.
Mike Clayton brings up a good point. Do you got a twitchy guy or a guy who's disciplined? Same question.
We're going to give you tax cuts.
20% in that water? Yeah. Put gin in that. 20% sale in beans below $6, otherwise $6.20. No corn hedges at this time. We're still holding out for $2.55. If we're right about wheat being under value, combined with the fact that corn exports have started to kick into a better gear, combined with the fact that most fall prices are 210 to 215 right now, we want to take some risk in corn right now and not hedge anything.
Tim?
Well, you know, last year when I sat on this panel at a different location, I was told that the sharks were going to eat me at the bottom of the ocean. You remember that one? When I gave my outlook on corn. Soybeans, I think you have to be real flexible, but I would be aggressive at selling soybeans in the 622 to 640 area. I think you got to sell 20 to 24 bushel an acre. I think you got to get aggressive. with that being said, I think you have to keep a flexible strategy on good South American production news. I think you got to come in and you got to buy some $7 calls, either the SEP or the NOV. Now, those would be out of the money, but, you know, right now you're talking about spending 22 to 25 cents a bushel, and working with farmers for the past 19 years, it's tough to get you to spend more than that. On soybeans, for an option, unless you want to do some creative accounting, it's tough to get you guys to pony up to spend more than that. But I think on good news, when the market's going down, if you get some sowed, get you some insurance. Get you some calls purchased back there, because anything can happen between now and fall. Maybe things don't turn out as rosy as they did this year and we go the other direction, or South American does hiccup. But that's where I'd be, 20 to 24 bushel, above 622, below 640. I'd get aggressive in there. And like these guys, everything we're telling you right now is as we see it today. Stay tuned. Things change. We can change our mind pretty quickly, can't we, guys? In corn, I have a friendly bias in corn also. I did last year. Had good opportunities to get corn sowed last year at my chart objectives, just didn't get enough sowed. But I would be 266, 272. I think you sell somewhere between 60 and 80 bushel an acre. And knowing that on a break in the marketplace, you got to come back in. From a technical perspective, if you see the market get above 312 December futures and you got a bunch of sales on the book, you better get a hold of a commodity broker and start to do some thinking about how you're going to cover what you got sold.
We've come to the point where we have some opportunity for you to ask questions of our panel of experts. I know we have some students here. I warn you ahead of time that we have about 15, 18, 20-ish minutes remaining. And if your grade is not too good at this point, you might want to jump in quicker than later. Questions for panelists. Who has one? Yes, sir.
I was on the same camp. I mean, that's all there is to it. We were really, I mean, we were in Jacksonville, Illinois in early August, just west of Springfield, and there was corn knee high, and it wasn't going to do anything. My mindset is, whether it's right or wrong, I think it's the mindset that the trade will take, that there is an artificial intelligence in corn at this point due to genetics, that if it doesn't rain, the plant doesn't die, it just shuts down until it gets the next rain. And I think that's really what I took away from this year, being in the exact same camp you were, is that every trader that I know up there that I appreciate, both former farmers and just plain, you know, day trade scalpers, they're all saying the same thing. You're not going to get a rust rally in soybeans this year, and you're not going to get a drought rally in corn out of us this year until USDA gives the number to us. And we're putting that into our 06 marketing plan.
Is it also true that just maybe that we put on weight, corn weight, in September off rain? There was a couple of timely rains that passed through there, and the thinking had been up to there that was too late to put on weight.
Well, and I asked, you know, several seed companies about that, and it was past nick. It was past pollination and the nicking of the kernels, and so I threw that element out, Dave, because of that, but I have no agronomy major, you know, or degree, that's for sure.
I think that factor is going to lead to future marketing and increase the volatility as we go, because that fact has led to complacency at Chicago. I think they believe right now that if you guys get it planted, you're going to raise 200 bushel an acre after last year.
In Las Vegas.
Yeah. I mean, that's the general thought of the traders at Chicago and those end users. So it may be tough to get the rally going, and it may be an after-the-fact situation.
Yes?
Last year, the panel discussed soybean rust. Why haven't you guys really touched upon that subject tonight?
This is a good question.
Soybeans or us? Clayton?
Well, we can talk about Y2K, too, I think. I mean, it was a big media sensation. It was obviously a real threat, but I think our technology, you know, I mean, you guys know how this was beat to death as far as all the seminars that were held everywhere, and everybody was told how to have their pocket microscope ready, and the chemicals were there ready to combat it. And I just think it's a dead issue. I mean, it never was that big of a deal as far as reported incidents, but even if it was, I really think that we're prepared to handle it. And I don't look for that to be a real big factor.
Mike, is it a dead issue? I mean, last year we discovered it in Kudzu in Florida.
Yeah.
And that sent tremors everywhere. Well, you know what? It's all over the South now. And if we don't get a hard freeze, it's going to have a firmer starting position the second year than the first year.
I think Clayton hit how the trade thinks of it right now. We still think it's a big issue in South America, but not until February. That avian flu, until more is known about that, avian flu trumps rust in Brazil and Argentina. Why? Because it's a demand issue. Who cares if the supply's short? The demand's going down. We don't need that. We don't need that supply anymore. You know, as far as our country goes, our weather guy, that's my oldest brother, has been very forthright and said, you just have to have the right conditions. You have to have it more or less in Texas, in Oklahoma, in Kansas for it to streamline itself up into the Corn Belt, and we know that now. And the other thing we know that we didn't know last year was from the plant pathologist at Ohio State, Ann Dorrance. She put out a thing on the news wires, I think the day the high was made, or within the day the high was made, that it was the end of July, early August, somewhere around there. She said, hey, full season beans are, you know, it's too far past where you can do any good with it anyway. It's not going to affect them. I truly don't think the market knew that at that point. I certainly didn't know that. But that early August, it didn't matter at that point.
Questions for the panel? Tim, do we care about rust?
Well, I think you always have to prepare. The industry should have a stockpile. They've had an additional year to prepare. With it in the South, as Dave alluded to, I think there's always the potential that it could be a problem. But with the producers in the United States, I think we'll stay on top of it. I don't think we'll get put it in the back seat and forget about it. But I think Chicago is going to have a proven case in the Midwest before they will give you a premium for soybean rust.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that you shouldn't, you know, be prepared physically to combat it. Far from that. What I said is I think that the market's fully aware that the tools are there to deal with it, and by all means, you know, you should use what tools are available. Unfortunately, it's an added expense, but.
Does bird flu go into 2006 summer?
From what I've seen, and this is World Health Organization maps and things like that, so you can check it out for yourself, but from what we've seen in the migratory patterns, February, March would be really the cutoff date to where it would have spread or not to major areas. But, you know, it's like Tim talked about before, it's a perception issue. It's like when Oprah went on about the cattle, you know, a few years back and the mad cow. It's as much perception and the lost demand due to perception. And, you know, there's concrete evidence that the poultry consumption is going down in those countries. And so we need some good news out there. We need someone to come out and say, we got enough Tamiflu, we can get the birds vaccinated, it's not going to switch to humans and be a pandemic. That kind of stuff would be very welcome this winter.
Questions for our panelists? Yes, sir. Barge traffic, and particularly in light of Katrina, Tim.
Well, what we've seen in the post-Katrina shipping, barge freight from Evansville, Indiana, went up about 5.5 times normal. And we went from about 15.5 cents to almost 81 cents a bushel for corn to take corn from Evansville to the Gulf. So
all that does is you add 60 to 70 extra cents to the export market, and maybe or maybe not are we competitive in the world anymore with that type of cost to get there. Plus, you had the turnaround time. If we go back, the day Katrina hit, I think the basis at Evansville for spot corn, and we were just starting harvest in southern Indiana, southern Illinois, the basis was 13 under the deece for spot corn. 2 days later, we were 47 under the deece because no one could get barges. They were afraid. They were tied up. They didn't want them coming there. When are they going to open the elevators? When are they going to be able to load? 14 days later, when we had the first turnaround, basis at Evansville went back down to 23 under the deece. And then from that time frame, we get harvest going in full bore, and I think the widest basis at Evansville was minus 51 on October the 4th. So we went full cycle. We built up a supply, but the main thing I think it did, it's eliminated demand for a while because of the higher price of the grain that got to the Gulf.
Well, the elevators played it wrong. They were in the same boat that everybody else was in terms of thinking the crop was going to be short. So they put old crop, left it in the elevators, and the big crop comes, and lo and behold, we got piles of corn all over the place, Clayton, including in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, at the Andersons. I believe the number is 3 million bushels of corn on the ground. Given that we're getting rather late in the season, are the elevators playing a little bit of Russian roulette on getting that corn out and down the river?
Well, I think they're doing what they can. I mean, they're moving it out really fast. They have pulled this together a lot faster than it looked like they might for a while. But and I don't know if your question was really directed at you know, just the recent problems post-Katrina or just in general. But obviously this has been a real extraordinary period we've been through and are still kind of working out of. But these elevators, they're doing what they can. I think the snapback in the basis has been real dramatic, like we've talked about, but probably would have even been more dramatic if you didn't have sort of this long tail on this transportation snafu that we've got going here. But they're getting it together. But I think it'll be back to normal before too long. But just real quickly, I'd say in general the barge traffic, and I don't know if you guys agree with this, I think you will, but I think in general that would tend to affect basis more than Chicago Board of Trade price.
Well, Mike, the basis rally, some are saying it ain't a demand rally, it's a transportation rally. And are they right? And if so, what does that imply?
Well, I think they're partially right. I mean, you know, we got the rail car situation that makes it very hard in the interior, and so it's a trickle-down issue. The Gulf will bid up so much, but like Tim said, until you get the price high enough, or when the price gets high enough that you bid yourself out of the export market, then it falls back. And so, I mean, our mindset has been, and we have this on fairly good authority by commercials, they're thinking right now in cash corn between now and July, August, they can make anywhere from 45 to 65 cents a bushel on what they have on the ground pile. That is a nice chunk of change, and they're probably right. And so that's the bottom line. It will move when they can make half or two-thirds of that amount. And then we can start, you know, really looking at some upside price potential, you know, in the cash. If the futures rallies and basis widens, it just suggests that it's not a cash-led rally. It's a situation where the cash bushels are still ample to take care of the demand. Until the futures rallies and the basis gets pulled up with it, that's when you really get happy if you need to sell some corn or have some long corn on.
Question for the audience. How many folk in the audience may have planted winter wheat that otherwise would have planted soybeans instead? Corn instead next spring? They've swapped out corn acres for wheat acres. Anybody do that? And you're going to double crop soybeans behind it, right? Did you do it because of the input costs on corn, projected input costs?
Partially.
No, yes?
Partially.
Partially? What's anhydrous going for this neck of the woods?
$600
a ton. This brings
if they can get it.
If you can get it, if you can get delivery. Some can't. Panel, this brings up an interesting question because it's in the minds of traders, but just maybe only in the minds of traders. There's some suggestion that perhaps as many as, throw out a number, 3 million acres have been planted to wheat that would otherwise be corn next spring. And then the theory is, do corn get bid up, or how does that all happen, and what is its potential? And I know Mike has handled this a few times.
Yeah, I mean, we'll keep it brief at this point. We're not really excited about the wheat pulling corn up when it comes to acres. We're excited about it from a price action and demands point and a futures low. What we are really watching is the Nov bean versus Dease corn ratio. There's two ways to get more corn acres. Nov beans go up and corn has to go up, or Nov beans go down and corn looks that much more attractive. If we drop 60 cents in beans between now and March, folks are going to look at that $600 a ton anhydrous and say, hey, well, my ground moisture level's improved. I might as well go ahead and plant the corn because I can get the yield. So that's where we sit right now at this point, Dave, is I think that's one of the things about we realized about the hedging program. When you look at 06 beans and corn, it's kind of a hedge on a hedge. And what I mean by that is if you hedge beans and you feel like you're getting too aggressive and the market starts going up in the wintertime, there's a pretty good likelihood then the corn's going to have to start ratcheting up a new crop. So by not being hedged that much in corn and working on the beans mainly, then you're going to be at a point where you might be hedging a hedge. So if you're wrong by hedging beans, you're going to make some of that up with the new crop corn at this time of year anyway, until we get planted.
What do you think about, like, I know we've already decided what we're going to plant. Seed spot, I mean, it doesn't, I guess if it was huge, it would make a difference, but chances are, it doesn't matter what the prices do, we're already locked into our seed purchases and stuff like that, and half of our ground sprayed.
You know, it goes back to, will we till up wheat in Lafayette? You know, yeah, if the stand doesn't look good and the corn price is good enough, I think that makes more of a difference than.
But I mean, on like the corn bean ratios.
Oh, I think guys will sell seed back. I think farmers would go ahead and move seed back to their seed dealer and say, get me a pallet of corn if the corn started rallying, or get me a pallet of beans. I'm going to do this field and this field less in beans or less in corn. Yeah, I do think that matters.
Questions for the panels? Going once. Yes, sir. In front first.
Guy came, guest spoke in class the other day and said something about the political side of farming. He said that they were trying to pass a bill of some sort about keeping farmers from farming after dark. You guys know anything about that?
I hadn't heard that.
Not aware of it. Not aware of it, but that would have a drastic effect on the farm economy because it would restrict the amount of work that an individual operation could do. So, you know, if we're going to go to politically correct laws that's going to govern the farm industry, it'd make it real tough.
Sounds
on large
like
operations.
Sounds like it was written by John Deere.
Sounds like, well.
None of you get that question.
You going?
Lincoln Land is right here in the front row. Stand up, please.
I can stay.
Jeff,
okay.
Ethanol production is going to continue to increase. There's no doubt about that. Through 2012, at least, we're going to see continued expansion every year. As far as the energy ratio, with the efficiencies of the plants that are being built today and the efficiency of the farmer is to raise the crop, we're going to see the energy efficiencies. Energy to efficiency in ethanol is going to always be a positive energy generator to producing the ethanol.
I would guess that it's a function of unleaded price versus natural gas price, because ethanol is based off unleaded. Natural is an input cost that can be as much as 30% of production cost for an ethanol plant. That's what our working assumption is from an economic standpoint, that if somehow unleaded would go down and natural would go up, that's when your EBITDA numbers would get really squeezed.
Jeff, you made five different faces there, so I'm not quite sure which one is right.
Yeah, I guess I don't agree with that.
Okay.
We've seen the very best of ethanol prices and the very lowest of ethanol prices with the same corn prices at both high natural gas and low natural gas. So I don't know if there's a correlation between unleaded ethanol and natural gas. I don't know what the triangle would be there.
We've seen in Lafayette this summer 89 be a nickel to 7 cents cheaper than 87 because the 89 has ethanol in it.
And that, if you go to the gas pump today, you probably see E85 at 7 or 8 cents above the E10.
Too. Right.
So, you know, there's not really a correlation unleaded to ethanol at all. It's definitely a supply and demand thing. Back in April, we had too much supply, and so we saw $1 ethanol. Right now, we have demand just skyrocketing in ethanol, and so you're seeing higher ethanol prices, and that's showing up.
Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, we have 91 ethanol plants in the Midwest right now.
I believe that's right.
Three of those under major expansion, and we've got 19 under construction.
That's probably old data. There's probably more than that.
So when we're looking at consumption of corn, if all those plants are going to run, you know, we're looking at quite an expansion of usage in corn with all those plants up and running.
Did you get them all answered, or did you have another one in there? You want to take another bite at the apple? No? A few more questions. Yes, sir?
If the demand of ethanol is so great and the price of ethanol is competing with the unleaded, how are you going to keep people buying the ethanol product?
It'll continue.
Jeff, that's your question.
I'll point to Jeff.
As states continue to mandate ethanol, that's going to increase the demand just on a statewide basis. Not every gallon of gas today is being blended with ethanol. So the demand is going to continue to be there. It's just how the supply is able to keep up with that demand. And with all the plants that are coming on, there's going to be a point in time where that's going to start regulating.
What sets the price of ethanol?
Demand.
Well, is it traded where? I mean, is there somewhere it's got to be?
Ethanol has a rack that trades just like unleaded gasoline, and it trades basically on the demand of that rack at the time. There's not, of course, we have ethanol futures.
Yeah.
They don't correlate with what we're seeing anyway at the racks, and it's just a supply and demand thing today.
Aren't both of those ethanol plants in a cooling organization, though, and they cool that ethanol?
There are some plants that operate out of cool, but not all plants do that.
Yes, sir?
Yeah, I'd just like to know if we have an average crop in Brazil, average crop next year in America, LDP on beans, yes or no?
Yes.
Big LDP?
I think so.
Percentage of what the corn LDP is? I think you could look at the same percent you could look this year.
We put average price at $5.05 on new crop beans. U.S. average U.S. price. That's a $3.81 carryover.
You know, there's so many factors that could kick in. What's the Asian flu going to do with demand this year? Where's supply in the world going to end up? We're at record supply, world stocks right, 46, 47 million metric tons. You know, if we use less, we produce good crops there and good crops here, we get ending stocks over 50 million metric tons in the world. That'd be an all-time record. There's nothing in my cards that says you shouldn't visit the area that you visited in 1999 and 2000. and that was real close to $4, like four and a nickel.
I
So if you were just a supply and demand analyst, and we continue to build those world stocks, and something happens with the Asian flu or whatever to slow down demand, we could have a real price squeeze on our hands. So from my cards, and I know Dave and I talked about this earlier, well, your 85% insurance becomes pretty important.
We have time for one or two more questions. Going once, going twice.
Going back to South America, the last couple of years, their crop has not panned out to early estimates, and they're fighting rust continually, and supposedly getting better at it and effectively managing it the more you hear as time goes by. But in my mind, I'm wondering how much of their yield demise is continuing to be a result of rust that they supposedly, what I read, they are controlling and learning to manage better. Is rust really creating a lot of their shortages, or is it drought related? I mean, do you guys have good information that says, because if that's the case, their rust started and began building and supposedly they're managing. Well, we're at the same threshold here. They could have been 3 or 4 years ago of it just starting, get a foothold the first year. And if next year, or this coming year, if we've got a foothold of it in Louisiana or those states where it started, and our tropics continue to be active like they were, and I think the forecast is probably, you know, if we have a lot more of an inoculum in those areas, and we get those hurricanes right up through here, rust can't be overlooked, in my mind, in the eyes of the market. I mean, unless...
No, I think what you bring up is a real good point. What has happened in South America is rust has hurt them from a standpoint of cost of production to combat it. Yeah, they can fight it, but that means hitting it 3 and 4 times to where it's too expensive to raise beans. I think we're under the mindset that they've hit a wall in terms of cost of production at this point. And why would we say that? Because they're starting to shut down crushing mills. Now, part of that's currency related, but still, that goes back to whether the you know, fungicide's priced in U.S. dollars and they have to buy it in American dollars or Brazilian real. So regardless of those factors, I think you've had a rust issue where they've hit the wall in cost of production to get a decent yield in these big farms. So that's number one. Number two, at the Farm Science Review in Ohio, in I think it was in September we were over there, we were on a panel with Ann Dorrance, this plant pathologist at Ohio State, sharp lady. She's going down to Brazil several times this winter. They have opened up their doors to the United States technology. They're on the hunt, and the word is within 3 years they are going to be able to fight it and fight it good to where their cost of production comes back down. So I think it's a, you know, right now they're having a tough time, but the technology is trying to beat it back down.